from KQED.
Welcome back to Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. An estimated 10,000 Cambodians live in the Bay Area, many of whom came here as children. And in her recent book, Exile, journalist Katja Senga follows four refugee families who fled the Pol Pot regime in the 1970s. She joins us now to discuss their stories, and we're going to hear how they are dealing with the threat of deportation as the White House seeks to remove some protections for immigrants who arrived before 1995. And we welcome you to the program, Katja Senga.
Thank you so much for having me here.
Glad to have you here. And the stories you write about are heartrending. You're talking about families who are really facing deportation, many of them people who have certainly become identified in their own minds as being Americans and are American citizens. But an uptick during the Trump administration, let's go back to really what we're talking about here, because it goes back to 1995.
Yes. So the laws that actually make this possible were passed in the 90s, and those laws were made so you could, in the retroactive, that people who are legal permanent residents but not citizens can face deportation if they have committed a felony. But felonies under immigration law, they made it, are different than under if you're a U.S. citizen. It gets really complicated, but basically those are the ones that made it. A lot of these people I write about, they came to the U.S. as young children in the 1980s or so after the Pol Pot regime in Cambodia. Then they did not become citizens, another complicated process why that didn't happen and such, but then they got in trouble with the law sometimes, for shoplifting, writing bad checks, some more extreme murder, but then they faced deportation after that because of those laws. And it has been happening since 2003 for Cambodians, but Trump has upped it. The biggest flight of Cambodian Americans sent back to Cambodia was in December under Trump.
And the biggest number of Cambodians, I guess, here in California, in Stockton and Long Beach. So we're not talking about citizens. We're talking about people who essentially are here and have lived here for many years and who have a heritage of a generation of violence. I mean, through the generations and through the continents. And it goes back to the killing fields.
Yes. And I think, yeah, they are legal permanent residents. And that's one of the things. These are generational trauma. We're talking people who I think their studies when they were resettled here, around 90% had someone been murdered that they knew of after the killing fields. 20-25%, I believe, of the Cambodian population wiped out. And so then they come here, resettled for the large part in what we would call ghettos back in the 1980s, war on crack, all those things. And
impoverished areas, basically.
Yes, yes. And a lot of times they didn't have, back then, a lot of the families I spoke with, there wasn't an ESL program at school or something. They fell through the cracks in a lot of ways because language problems, culture problems, trauma. Some of my families, I remember, she faced abuse from a loved one was abusing her, and I asked why she didn't call the police, and she said, well, you wouldn't call the police under the Khmer Rouge. They'd just, you know, kill you. So it's things we don't understand from our perspective why they didn't end up becoming citizens. Also, citizenship costs a lot of money, and at the time, the U.S. has a program that refugees don't get automatic citizenship. You have to wait. You have to apply. And the U.S.
This is refugee resettlement, though, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. But under refugee resettlement, you come in as legal permanent residents, but it's a number of other steps to become a citizen. It's not automatic, whereas in a lot of countries it is, and the U.N. criticizes us for that. And so for various reasons, a lot of these families, sometimes money, sometimes not even knowing, a lot of the ones I write about, they came as kids, and they didn't even realize they weren't citizens. And also it says permanent residents, so they figured they were safe.
That's easy to confuse with citizenship. I think
yeah.
That's the point. But these were often second generation exposed to PTSD, having endured and having a history, a lineage, if you will, of trauma, as you said, of brutality and of genocide.
Yeah, and growing up even with parents who had endured that, who maybe weren't able to talk about it and such. And then that generation, that second generation, trying to fit in. One of the families grew up in Stockton, not far from here, and there was the re-traumatization in that, I think it was in the 1980s, there was a school shooting, and they killed all Cambodian and Vietnamese children. There were, I think it just celebrated, not celebrated, marked an anniversary on that. But so one of the gentlemen I write about, Touch, he grew up in Stockton, had survived the killing fields as a very young child, came here maybe 5-7 years old, and then went to that school, and there was that shooting when he was there. His family was okay, but his family talks about how he became re-traumatized then, and he talks about how the older generation thought they were safe in the U.S., and then having that shooting there kind of put them back into it. For a lot of the families, the deportation is a re-traumatization as well, because under the Khmer Rouge, they separated families. That was part of the program. People were put in work camps and murdered, starved to death, all sorts of things, but separation of families. And so when the older generation realized, even though it's sometimes their adult children might go back to Cambodia, this re-traumatizes them, brings back the separation that they faced. So it's really about this continuation of extreme trauma for these communities.
Talking with, if you've just joined us, Katya Sengel. She's a journalist. She's the author of Exiled, From the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. How does this compare to the Vietnam refugees?
That's a good question. And it's interesting because, well, with Cambodia, Vietnam also trauma, but it was the war. Cambodia was an actual genocide where it killed, like I said, I think 20 to 25% of the population just wiped out, either starved or murdered or disease. And during that time, under the Khmer Rouge, they got rid of education. I mean, the whole country just was thrown into chaos, went back to year zero, killed off all the doctors, all the educated class. So there was a lot of the Cambodians resettled in the U.S. Literacy was an issue because a lot of the educated class was killed and murdered. And so they were starting from a different level there. One of the families I write about, it's Tucho's older brother, actually, he was illiterate in Khmer, and then he came here as a teenager. So he had to not only learn English, but become literate when he wasn't even literate in his native language. So there was the less education in a lot of ways. And then when the Cambodians came here, their country had less room to negotiate. So the treaty, they call it the Memorandum of Understanding between Cambodia and the U.S., says you can deport anyone. With Vietnam, it says you can't deport those who came as refugees, so before some year in the 1990s. And so those who came as refugees, the bulk, are not subject to deportation originally. Now, Trump has been actually, and I'm not sure the latest update on this, because he was actually trying to deport some of those from who came as refugees from Vietnam who originally were protected by this Memorandum of Understanding. Complicated thing is it's a memorandum of understanding. It's not a legal document as much from what I understand. So he can, I guess, legally do that, even though there's a lot of trying to push back.
Can do it and has been doing it.
Yes.
In fact, one of the profiles in your book is a young man named David Ross who is facing deportation. My understanding is that ISIS actually came for him. He managed to not be there at the time they came for him. But Cambodia had issued a travel document to ICE to deport him, and he wasn't there. And he says he wasn't in violation of anything. He was trying to live a life, had an ill mother, had a son he had to care for, and so on. Also had a record, though. I mean, as a young man, he had killed somebody.
Yeah, he was 16 when he killed someone, so he was a juvenile but sentenced as an adult. Did almost 20 years and completely pretty much came out a different person, as his family says, and had started building his life, had a relationship, had a son, Solomon, who he's very close with, but was also has this hanging over his head. So now he checks in regularly, and any time he could be taken. And there was a raid where he luckily was not home when they came for him. But he faces the issue of his son Solomon. I think Solomon's now 7 and is a U.S. citizen. And so what happens if he is deported to Solomon?
Waiting for his travel document to expire, or at least hope. He's up in the air, basically, in limbo. Yeah,
yeah, that's what he says, living in limbo. And he has to have... He has no status, so he has a job, but he has to apply for a special document to actually work, which is actually pretty expensive, because there is this limbo, and several of them are like that.
Do you think it's unreasonable, though, that a murderer should be sent back to Cambodia? I mean, despite the fact that he did his time and, you know, show some reforming of character that may indeed be... speak well of him as far as resurrecting his life or putting it in the right position, but nevertheless... convicted murder.
Yeah, no, that's a very valid question. I think for me, the big thing is David came here very young, 4 or 5, something like that, and pretty much grew up here. And some of the things that made him become who he was both the environment here and what his family had endured in Cambodia. And I think for me, the big thing is, I don't know that it solves anything by sending him back to Cambodia, because at this point, he did do time. He served his full time for his crime. And sending him back there will affect Solomon, who is a U.S. citizen now, will then grow up without a father. So David's father was murdered under the Khmer Rouge. He grew up without a father. And so then if we send him away, Solomon's going to grow up without a father. His mother is going to be re-traumatized by losing her son again. And the community, just this continual traumatization. The other problem is it doesn't really help Cambodia either to send someone who doesn't have the skills to relate. David's a good exception. He actually, while in prison, studied Khmer. I think he can write and read it now. A lot of them can't. And so you're sending them to a country that isn't necessarily equipped to handle them either or to help them integrate. So
they don't have the skills. They don't have the network.
Exactly.
Connections. They really have no. We're talking again with Katya Sengel. I'm going to invite calls here. She's a journalist and the author of Exiled from the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. And if you're a part of the Bay Area Cambodian community, we'd certainly like to hear from you. And you can call us now, or if you have questions or comments for our guest. Our toll-free number is available. It's 866-733-6786. Again, you can join us right now at 866-733-6786 or post comments on our website, kqed.org/forum, or on Facebook, or tweet us at KQED Forum, or you can email us forum@kqed.org, but we do invite your involvement in the program. What do you suppose is going to happen to this whole ongoing saga, especially with refugee settlements? So we're going to be talking about Governor Newsom's State of the State address, and I suppose there's a lot of hope with maybe things changing under Gavin Newsom.
I think there was big hope a couple years ago before Trump was elected. And then I think there's always hope, and then there's fear. And then there's those who have already been deported to Cambodia. There are more than 300 there now. And I just saw an organization that works with them, one who had just been deported recently in December. He was just killed in a traffic accident in Cambodia. So their fate over there, often not well. Some are in prison. Some have been murdered or died of other causes. A lot of, because again, they have that emotional trauma and such, and Cambodia isn't equipped to deal with it in a lot of ways.
And they're not equipped to be in Cambodia. They've spent many years here in the United States. I'm just wondering, in fact, to what extent they can ever return to the United States. It seems really unlikely, especially in present political circumstances.
Yeah, it does. There was a movement to try and the right to return, and there's still a bit on that. But I do think, unfortunately, it probably will be very difficult. There are a few that have. One young woman I admire very much has really made the best of the situation. She's been traveling all over Asia and getting to do things she said she wouldn't have done if she was here. And she's been brave about it. But I remember her mom passed away here in the U.S. and she had to watch while they disconnected her from life support in the hospital. She had to watch on either Skype or some sort of video messaging thing. And I remember she said once she turned off that screen, it was so hard for her because then she's just all alone there in Cambodia, so far from her family. And she has a teenage son who's growing up here without her. So I think that's the big thing, is that family separation.
Well, we spoke about David Ross, and he's on the phone with us now.
Oh,
he's a Cambodian living in the United States, facing deportation, one of the subjects in your book. And David, welcome to the program. Good to have you.
Thank you, sir.
So what's your situation now? You're just hoping that ICE won't come beating on your door, I imagine, huh?
Well, I'm hoping they don't come anytime soon, because I'm trying to get myself set for myself and my son to be able to go to Cambodia on our own volition, at least our own time. Due to the fact that if I was to be detained, I would be stuck in ICE detention center from anywhere from between 6 to 10 months. And that's a huge waste of resources for everybody. And plus, being that I'm fully employed and I'm, you know, and I have a son, I'm a single father, I'm very worried about that. So my thing is that I'm hoping that they don't come anytime soon and that they will allow me to get my situation settled so that I can go when I'm ready to go, because it's not a matter of if, it's a matter of when. And I want to be able to control my own destiny somewhat.
You think of yourself as an American, don't you?
My son is an American, yes. He was born in August 17, 2011 in Renton, Washington.
Oh, I know your son is a citizen because he was born in the United States, but do you think of yourself as an American?
Oh,
or an American now more than a Cambodian?
Absolutely. I don't know too much about the Cambodian way of life anymore, except for what I learned growing up from my own family. But from my understanding, guys are having a hard time adjusting in Cambodia because we grow up here in America and we consider ourselves American. I mean, we know football, we know pizza, hamburger, and so forth. And to be deported into a whole new world, basically. I mean, I left that country when I was 5 years old. And then I was in a refugee camp for another 2.5. So I really do not remember Cambodia, but from what I learned on TV and from books.
David, what do you say to people who might indeed point to the fact that you were a convicted murderer and therefore why shouldn't you be sent back to Cambodia? We don't need convicted murderers here in the United States.
Well, what I say to them is I'm a human being. I made this mistake when I was 16 years old. I am 45 years old now. And ever since then, I have not committed an offense. I've been a hard worker. I've been paying taxes. And I've been living a life of an abiding citizen ever since. I made a mistake when I was 16 years old. And, you know, we all make mistakes. And I ask that people, you know, judge me for who I am today, not for what I did when I was a child.
And are you expecting, because some have said that there are going to be more ICE raids, are you indeed anticipating that, fearing it? What's your emotion at this point or your anticipation?
I'm always fearing it, sir, and I'm always expecting it. However, I used to stress out over it so much, especially when I hear that, oh, ICE is picking up so-and-so, and ICE is picking up Cambodians for deportation again. And I'm terrified because my son, you know, who's going to take care of my son? And so I live in fear pretty much every day, anticipating myself to be detained. But I wish for the best, and I hope that, you know, I always live every day, you know, in the moment and doing the best I can every day until I encounter that eventuality of them detaining me.
Your son's mother is not in the picture here? Your son's mother is not in the picture?
She is no longer in the picture. It's sad, but she does have visitation rights. And we are in communication. However, she's not in a position to take care of him or raise him or even nurture him in any kind of fashion.
Let me bring some callers aboard. David Ross with us is a Cambodian living in the United States facing deportation, one of the subjects of the book by our in-studio guest, Katya Sengal, the author of Exiled, From the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. And let's hear what our listeners have to say or ask. We begin, San, with you. Good morning. Hello?
Hello?
Yes, sir, you're on the air.
Hi. So I'm in the same situation. I was deported in 1994. And I came here when I was 12 years old. I'm from Laos. So I'm always afraid every day, just like David. And so what what should we do? I mean, we're just living here like we don't exist. I mean, everybody make mistakes, right? And we were young, and when we grew up, when we got here, the culture is new to us, and we don't know anything. So what can we do now?
Let me take that question to you, Katya, if I could. I mean, you've certainly looked into this research, had been a good journalist about it. What can you advise when you hear a question like that? What can we do?
Unfortunately, it's hard. David actually was active in the kind of resistance community trying to do something about this. And then right now, CREC is an organization that have petitions trying to fight and draw attention to this. And Asian Law Caucus here is also doing things. There was a big push to try and get people pardons so then they would not be deported right away and then it could go back. That doesn't save them from deportation. It's just immediate saves them. Then they have to kind of go through and get their cases retried. But so there have been, there are a lot of pushes with those activist communities to try and do that.
You mentioned Governor Brown actually did pardon a few people before he left
office.
He
did, yeah. But then there were some that they're now, the Supreme Court tried, California Supreme Court, I think there was one, they took back one of the pardons. But yeah, there were some pardons, and I think there's trying to get even more pardoned, but it's a slow process. We've got a lot of people in this situation, and you've got to have these organizations who have lawyers who will do it for free because a lot of people can't afford to have a lawyer to do this. So there is a movement to try and fight it. Asian Law Caucus and CREC are two of the big ones to get in contact with.
Well, we wish Sun good luck and to David Ross as well. And I just want to remind our listeners, this is a fundraising period for KQED Public Radio. For more information about how to support KQED, and we're talking with Katya Sengel and David Ross is with us as well, simply go to kqed.org. I'm Michael Krasny. And we'll go to another caller. We go next to Rachel. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hi, good morning, Michael. Thanks for picking me to talk. This is so heartbreaking and just one of so many horrible policies of this administration. And I just am wondering, do you recommend for citizens? I mean, I'm a woman whose mother lost over 50 people in the Holocaust, and watching this is just heartbreaking. What can citizens do? Do you recommend the same thing, CREC? An Asian Law Caucus, is there anything we can support, way to support this?
Yeah, I definitely recommend those two organizations. I know they had some petitions to sign to get, there was a Action Week, I think it was Martin Luther King Holiday, there was an Action Week on this to try and end the deportations and such, and they still have petitions that you can sign. So if you look for CREC or Asian Law Caucus, you'll find information about those so you can sign those. You can also write your congressman. And David was actually really big on the activist community as well, so he might have advice on that as well.
Some advice from you, David.
Well, at this point right now, all we can do is back Asian Law Caucus and CREC because they are the biggest two in the front line here helping, as well as we can donate money because a lot of times when we do things, organization, it's all volunteer work. And we kind of, we give our time and even our own resources to help with this movement and this cause. So any kind of donation financially would be great, and even your time to, Katya was saying, put pressure on your congressman. We need to bring awareness to this, and I'm sure they are aware, but there's not enough pressure to have them think twice about what it is that they're doing, the family separation and sending back people back to the killing fields, basically, because a lot of guys are finding themselves very, very difficult to integrate over there because, we come from America. Even the Cambodians of the native, the native Cambodians don't see us as Cambodians anymore. They see us as American, and we're, by the way we walk, by the way we talk, they can tell right away that we're not from Cambodia. So yeah, any kind of pressure that you can put on your lawmakers would be excellent. That would be the first thing that we can do, is to let them know that this is wrong and that there needs to be some kind of amendment in this agreement. It's not a law. It's just an agreement between two countries that they came to this conclusion. And, with the gentleman that listened earlier, I want to comment to him is that Laos and Cambodia does not have the same kind of agreement. That's why Laos have not, they have not been able to deport the Laotian in mass numbers yet. But they are trying to put pressure on the Lao government to accept these deportees. And for them, they need to contact their lawmakers and also even the Lao government to not sign this agreement, because they have the choice not to sign. I mean, of course, America is going to try to put all kinds of pressure economically or politically and so forth to make them accept, but they can resist this, and they can put pressure on their lawmakers not to go forward with any agreement with Laos that would be the same as what Cambodia is facing right now.
David Ross, good to have you with us this morning. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you, sir.
It's David Ross, Cambodian living in the U.S. facing deportation, one of the subjects of Katya Sengel's book. Let's talk about some of the other subjects in your book. I mean, maybe what comes to mind that listeners would particularly want to know about that you've profiled here?
I think maybe Satie.
Somebody maybe close to home, I was thinking. Yeah.
That would probably be Tutch, because he grew up in Stockton. He now lives with his brother, more Orange County area. But Tutch came, again, probably around the same age as David. Sometimes ages are hard to gouge because records were destroyed under the Khmer Rouge, so ages are not always exact on that. But he was the one who had the school shooting, and it was interesting. He actually said, his family says, he was doing pretty well. He kind of had a mentor here, and the change for him when he started getting involved with gangs was after his mentor died and after that school shooting, and it seemed to put him on the wrong path there. And he did a lot of the, you'll hear from the community that they got involved in gangs almost as a self-defense, because they were thrown in the 80s, pretty violent time in inner cities. And they kind of had to defend themselves as the newest ones there, who their English wasn't perfect. They had the accent. They were the Asian kids, so they got picked on. So they say they kind of got the gangs as defense. With Tutch, actually, he had deportation orders, and all he was asking for was a stay of deportation. He wasn't fighting the deportation. He agreed to be deported, but he wanted to stay long enough to give a kidney to his older brother, who was facing kidney failure.
Now, these are poignant stories. And again, Katya Sengel's book is Exiled from the Killing Fields of Cambodia to California and Back. We've got seconds left, but a listener said, well, because people went through trauma, does that mean we should help them, or they should be concerned about them, compassionate toward them? Quick response from you on that?
I would like to think yes. I think that we bear some responsibility, too, to remember that we actually did extensive bombing in Cambodia during the Vietnam War that actually helped lead to the Khmer Rouge rising to power.
We're going to have to leave it there. Thank you.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, founders of the Minetti Schrem Museum of Art at UC Davis. On view through April 14th, Blue and Yellow Corridor, an iconic work by Bruce Nauman, realized on the very grounds where the artist conceived it.